Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Erica, and tonight I'm joined by Jeff.
Hi, everybody.
And Hope.
Hello.
And tonight's show is about happiness and how one can achieve it, and how consumerism can relate to this. So to start off tonight, I want to talk about what each of us think happiness, what it is, and how you can achieve it. And so I'll go first. And after reflecting on what happiness is and what makes me happy, I came to the conclusion that I think that happiness is being proud of yourself and how you live and work, and that satisfaction of being proud of yourself gives you happiness. And I think that its achievement comes from your actions primarily, but it can also come from others, because I think it's important to acknowledge that other people can affect your happiness. And so even though as much as we'd like our happiness to be something that we decide on, other people really can influence it. And so I think it's our job to ultimately decide to be happy and weed through the things that make us unhappy, which can include actions of others or even other people. And, you know, you have to decide to be positive and to be happy, but I recognize that this isn't always easy. And when I thought about happiness a little bit more, I think it's not something that's like a quick fix or an easy solution. It's something that you have to work on throughout your life and you have to be conscious of. And, you know, it's not going to be a quick fix, even though that would be easier. And when I think about sometimes when I'm not feeling as happy as I might want to be, you know, there are things that you do, such for me, which would be like retail therapy, and I like to go shopping. So, you know, that does make me feel better a little bit. But, you know, it's not like that lasting happiness, which is what we all are truly searching for. So I think it's not something quick. It's not retail therapy. It's something that you have to be conscious of and work on your entire life, and be mindful that, you know, others can influence you, but it's your job to make sure that you are happy. Jeff, what do you think about happiness?
Well, when I was preparing, I had a lot of things like flash in my mind when I was thinking about times that I was happy. So I really couldn't boil it down to one thing, but I have a couple of things that I think encompass my personal happiness, and that's I feel the most happy when I am productive, when I have a sense of accomplishment, a sense of thankfulness, or I feel like I'm a part of something. So I'm going to kind of explain each of those. First, by what I mean by being productive, for me, nothing is better than knowing that I either made something, created something, added something, or basically just did something of worth, or even I'm very happy when I'm engaged in those types of process. And I actually, thinking of when I'm the most happy, I think of the stuff that I do with you guys and the ICCSN and stuff, because it's one of those things that, like, while I know that we've all talked about it a lot, but it's one of those things that when you're engaged in it, you're so concentrated and time flies by. You're not really concentrated on anything else but the activity at hand. And the sense of feeling, it's almost like it's different than like the typical happiness that people think of, but it's just like you just feel good about what you're doing at that particular moment. And I think that's one of the most times that I feel most happy. Also, I mentioned feeling accomplished, which is along the same lines. But for me, setting a goal and achieving it is one of the, like, looking back in my life when I've set a goal, like, whether it be with sports, education, specifically education and grades and test scores. But when I put my mind to it and achieve the goal that I wanted to, like, that sense of accomplishment is one of the happiest that I could ever be. And, yeah, so the productivity and accomplishment are two big things. And then I also struggle for, I call it thankful, but I'm not sure if that's the best term for it, but there are these times when you're not really doing anything in particular, but you just feel, like, happy and thankful to be alive. And, you know, like, specifically, I think when I'm up north with my family and, you know, we're just talking and not really doing anything of worth per se, but it's just one of those times where you're just like, it feels good to be alive, and it's just really heartwarming, I guess, to say. And then lastly, feeling a part of something and, like, feeling that solidarity with people. I think that's what you were touching upon with getting happiness from other people, like recognition from another person that you're valuable or that you're worth something to them, just makes you feel a lot better. Specifically from your family, your friends, the groups that you belong to, like knowing that you're valuable to other people just gives you a happy feeling. But at the same time, actually one of the things that really changed my life and got me turned on to philosophy in the first place was reading Epictetus, I think that's however you pronounce it. But basically the message is that you don't have control over anything but yourself and your own actions. And, I mean, that's boiled down way, well, I mean, distilled a lot. But basically that just changed everything for me, because once you realize that you don't have control over the weather, you don't have control over your friends, you don't have control over your professors, anything, the only thing you have control over is yourself, and thus your own happiness can be derived from yourself. And it's just, A, it's empowering, and B, it really gives you a strong idea that you don't need anything outside of yourself to produce happiness. Now, granted, I think it's a lot easier to be happy around people and in situations that you enjoy, first of all. But like I said, the people that give you recognition of your worth, I think it's a lot easier to be happy. But at the end of the day, to use a quote from Jack, who we missed, but at the end of the day, you know, your happiness is really derived from yourself. But those four things are really the things that I get the most happiness from.
Okay, thank you. And everything you just said made me happy, and I think I felt the warm fuzzies. Hope, do you have anything to say about happiness and how you achieve it?
I'm just going to try to be a little brief. And I just want to follow up on some things that both of you said and connect them with, one with Aristotle and two with the concept of flow, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who I've talked about repeatedly on this show. But first, Erica, you made the claim that this is not something that's easy, and it's something that you work on. And in the opening book of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, he says that very thing. He's concerned with what happiness is, and he raises the possibility that it's something that, you know, either you receive God's grace or you don't. I mean, this is pre-Christianity. But there was a belief at the time that the God smiled on some people and not on other, and basically you were chosen. And it was just dumb luck, really, and you had no role in it. And he rejects that, and he says it just makes no sense that happiness, something so important, would be so random like that and arbitrary. So he's very insistent that it's something that is worked on and something that requires actually hard work. So I think that's an important point to make. And I think that what you're saying is the same thing that Aristotle mm-hmm. says. So I think that's very interesting that over 2,000 years later, we're echoing same ideas. Perhaps human beings recognize something throughout generations. Also, this idea, Jeff, that you were talking about when you're working on something and you're working on ICCSN stuff, for example, that is what I hear you talking about is the concept of flow. And again, this is what is identified by scientific research as optimal experience. So I use this phrase, I think it's easy. Life offers us a smorgasbord of pleasures. And one pleasure on the menu, you know, for example, is the pleasure that you get from eating pizza. And another pleasure is the pleasure that you get from, you know, just slacking off and watching TV all day. Retail therapy is another pleasure. So there's all these different things that give us pleasure. The highest one, based on the research, is this pleasure produced by a flow activity where, as you said, you described it, you sort of are totally united with the activity. You lose all sense of time. You look at the watch and go, my God, 3 hours later. Mm-hmm. And you're really united with this activity. I think that there we can also distinguish between a smorgasbord of flow activities. I think you can watch TV and be like, oh, my God, 6 hours later. But there's, and I think we would say that's a passive activity, right? And that's not life, like happiness is not just watching TV, even though that can be a flow activity. So there's like bad flow or unproductive flow. So for me, and this connects with what you're both saying about productivity being connected to happiness, is a, it's a type of flow activity involved in productive, a type of productive activity that resonates with your core values. I can just speak personally, like, I really, at this point in my life, I never have cared about the, you know, environmental justice, nor do I really care. I mean, I like the environment, but it's not something that gets me fired up, nor do I care about animal ethics. I love animals. I have two dogs, love them, but this is not, these are not issues that I get really transfixed on. And so for each person, it's going to be some certain thing that riles them up of value. And so it's finding what that is and then doing activities that channel that, that value. So, period, done. That's what I think.
All right. So I think everything that's just been said, you know, there's a lot of themes that are the same in what all three of us just said. But, you know, happiness is going to be unique to each person. And now I'd like to talk a little bit about happiness and how our society appears to try achieving it through consumerism. And I think this is something that's pretty visible to everyone, that especially in American society, it's a lot about more, 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 and what can I get, and what can money buy. And if I have this career, I'll be making more money, and I'll have more things that will make me happy. Even as we head into the Christmas season, there's so many commercials out and so much advertising for buy this, buy that, you know, have a Merry Christmas with all your new things. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about is this concept of a hedonic treadmill. And basically what this is, and the way I understand it, is a person is at like an economic status in their life, and they want more. So there's a person, a middle class person, you know, making whatever $40,000 a year, and they want like a bigger house. They're at a certain status, and they want more. They want a bigger house. But they achieve a raise, and they earn more money, and they get the bigger house, which should make them happy. But once they achieve this next level of status and are earning more money, they only want more. And so they're never any more happy than what they started out, because their happiness and their desire moves in tandem. And like in the various descriptions of this hedonic treadmill, they describe it sort of as rungs of a ladder, whereas if you move, if your desire, or if your status is at one rung and one rung above it is your desire, if you move up, then so does, if your status moves up, so does your desire. Like they move in tandem, and you'll always be wanting more, even if you achieve more. And so, you know, I think this is definitely true. I mean, people enjoy being successful. People enjoy an easier life. And so once they achieve a certain status, they want even more. But then, you know, it makes you question, like, when is ever enough? And when, if you're not happy, any more happy with more stuff, each time your status moves up in this world, like, when will you really be happy, and how can you be happy? So what do you guys think about this, Jeff?
I have a lot to say about this, so I'm going to try and be organized with my thoughts. First of all, I think that it accurately describes a common phenomenon, especially within our society, and I think it's very accurate, but I don't think that it's a person is necessarily subject to it. And what I mean by that is that I think a lot of people do take pleasure in material things and seeking status for the sake of that status. I know that Hopes brought this up in one of our classes, but a great example is becoming a doctor for the money and not for the principle of helping people, which I think is, I mean, it's a great example of what is going on. A lot of people right now are in college to make money and to make get a good job, which to me isn't the correct way to look at it. I mean, honestly, when that question is asked, like, why are you here, the first question that's, or the first answer that's always brought up is to get a good job, to make a lot of money. And yeah, money is important because money does make the world go round and you need money to do things, but the goal of your life should not be just to accrue as much money as you can, because obviously you can't take it with you when you go. I don't want to be a person who looks back and is like, okay, yeah, I'm sitting on a bunch of money, but I have no friends and I have no one to share it with. Like, that's not what I want, and I don't think that's really what anyone wants. But the way that they go about it in this hedonic treadmill style is that's essentially what's going to happen. For me, and I think this is Aristotelian in nature, is like I said before, I find happiness in achieving my goals, and I think that life is really all about goals, and you set short-term goals in order to accomplish longer-term goals and in order to accomplish a lifelong goal, which I think the lifelong goal is to be happy. But along the way, you need to do certain things in order to achieve that. Like, an example is if you're going to write a paper, okay, well, a research paper, let's say. Well, first you need to do the research, and in order to do that, you need to find sources, and you need to physically go somewhere or get on your laptop and get them, whatever. Then you need to outline it, and then you need to write it, and then you need to revise it, and then you have the paper. So that's to me how life works. You have to do all these little things to achieve your ultimate goal of happiness. And if people are confused about these goals and try to and place monetary values on these goals, then yeah, then you're going to be in the hedonic treadmill. And then, yes, then I think the hedonic treadmill is very accurate that you're never going to find happiness. But I think when I was reading some of the articles that you gave us, one of them said that there's two reasons for this. One's habitual nature, which is getting used to your conditions, and then you're used to them, then you're not happy with them anymore. And then the second one is competition. Well, I don't think that either of those necessarily means that you're going to be on the hedonic treadmill. I think, first of all, getting used to your conditions may make you kind of complacent, but I think there's also something to be said about always improving. And I think that always improving is different than being stuck in a state where you're not happy. To me, it's like you buy a house first, and you're happy just because you have a house. And you're like, yes, I bought my first house. This is very good. And then, but you spend your life kind of, you paint the bathroom or whatever, you get a new kitchen, whatever. But by the end, you look back and you're like, my house is reflective of me, and that's exactly what I want. And I don't think that that necessarily means you're not happy, but there's a desire to always be improving. And I think that goes along with the goals and everything. But and then the second one, competition. I think that competition in the wrong way, where it's like the battle between the Joneses or something, mm-hmm. that's common, where you're always looking at your neighbor and your house has to be better than them or whatever. I find it ironic that one of the things that I get the most pleasure and happiness out of is competition. And not so much to put the other person down, but like in sports, you go up against the best games that I've been involved in is when you're up against a really equally matched opponent and you prove that you can win and you can do it. But I don't think it's, I don't know, like the sports things, I think that this is really a slippery slope, because if you do look at your happiness in comparison to other people, I think then, yes, you're subject to the hedonic treadmill. But if you're, like, competition just for the sake of competition, like, I think it goes back to my whole goals thing. Like, if you set a goal to win this game or, you know, to compete with another person and you win, I think it's more about you setting the goal for yourself. I think it's more of a personal thing. At least it is for me. So I don't think that these things necessarily subject one to the hedonic treadmill. So basically what I think I'm saying in sum is that when your goals do not include fulfilling pleasures, then the hedonic treadmill is relevant and very accurate. But when your goals do not include unfulfilling pleasures, then the hedonic treadmill is irrelevant. And what I mean by unfulfilling pleasures is, you know, money for the sake of money, the thing I talked about, the person becoming a doctor for the sake of getting the money and not for helping people. If you feel like you need material items to show off, I think that's what the person was talking about with competition. And, you know, just getting these statuses for the sake of the status and not for what it embodies, like having a doctorate in school or getting your master's degree just so you can have the letters in front of your name, when really those are signifying people who loved what they were doing, did it to do it and enjoyed doing it and did it to advance themselves and to add something to the world. And I think that that's all kind of being lost, and all like the value to things are being substituted with money, and it's all being boiled down to that. So, like I said before, I think what I'm doing is taking an Aristotelian stance in that if you find pleasure in fulfilling activities and the right sort of activities, then you're going to find happiness regardless of the material possessions you have. That being said, I think there is something to the more money you have, the easier it is to be happy. Like for me personally, one of the things that really make me happy is snowmobiling, and that is a very, very expensive activity. I mean, a brand new sled, a sled is a snowmobile for people who are in the activity. But a good snowmobile today is like $8,000. And, I mean, you can find one for, regardless, you're going to have to spend a couple $1,000s to be able to do it. And, I mean, if you don't have extra money, if you don't have a couple $1,000s that you can just do whatever with, you can't snowmobile. But then I was thinking, you know, well, geez, I'm saying that material things don't make you happy, and then I'm going to say, but the material item in the snowmobile makes me happy. But then I was thinking, you know, the reason that I love snowmobiling is because it's a family event. We get all of our family out there, and it's a great time to hang out with my aunts and uncles and cousins, and you're out in nature, which is awesome. You're in these points of the world where the only people that you see are the people that you're riding with, and you're just in nature, and it's, first of all, it's beautiful, all the snow on the trees. Like, it's just a really fun activity, and I think that's the reason that I get happiness from it. It's not the snowmobile. It's not the material things, even though I do like to have the fastest snowmobile and all that. But that's ultimately not why I'm getting the happiness out of it. So I think when it's all said and done, money and wealth make it easier in that it allows you to concentrate on the things that make you happy and avoid roadblocks to it, which I think I've heard that somewhere, so I'm not going to take credit for that. But I think that that's absolutely true, and that it definitely allows you to concentrate more on the things that you enjoy. But at the end of the day, Jack again, you know, it's not about the material possessions, even though your material possessions may make it easier. But again, if you find happiness in the value rather than the money aspect of it, then I think that the hedonic treadmill is irrelevant.
I totally agree in everything you've said about, you know, these, like, the actions of you, like, using the material items to generate happiness. I think that, you know, that has to be recognized, too. And I think that that's really, like, that you can still achieve, like, a true happiness by using, like, resources and money to act in a certain way that generates happiness. Or, I mean, I think about people that are really involved in, like, philanthropy, and they have lots and lots and lots of money, but, like, they decide to, you know, whatever, create a foundation or donate to something, because they are happy for doing something good with their money, and their money is making somebody else happier because it's enriching their lives some way. And, you know, you can, like, give a material thing to somebody, but if, like, say you're enriching somebody's life through education or something of that nature, I feel like that's, like, a more true happiness, too, and more lasting. So I think that we've kind of talked about that a little bit with you before, Hope, how, like, when you're giving something, it's important to remember, like, how you're giving it and, like, what you are really giving, because if you give something that, like, education versus giving somebody, like, you know, a material thing, new clothes or something, like, education is going to be a much more lasting happiness, like, the money you spend on that, because it Yeah, it's just more lasting. Wow, I really went well on that one. Hey, everybody.
I must say, though, that I have some shoes that have always caused happiness for me. I've had them for many years, and I just stare at them. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Hope, what do you think about the hedonic treadmill?
I just want to comment on some things that Jeff said and which relate to it, which is this, so there's money and there's activity. There's money and there's meaningful activity or value-driven activity. And I think something happens, and this has been demonstrated with research, that something happens to our focus and our attention once they're called external motivators are put into the mix. So external motivators are things that are outside of the activity, like grades, prizes, money, awards, things like this. And again, to quote Socrates, Plato, wealth does not bring virtue, but from virtue comes wealth and all other good things known to man. So here's the rub. If you are doing something with excellence, there's an increased likelihood that success will come your way, either in terms of money or status, or people will recognize you and start, you know, doing things for you, giving you things, recognizing in some way. And if you're not really clear and it's not entrenched in you why you're doing what you're doing, then your attention can be diverted to those accolades and those rewards. And so there's a shift that happens to attention. This is demonstrated with what's an area of research called self-determination theory. And this is the problem. And I think that in order for us to remember why it is what we're doing and what's important, and Jeff, you know, it's this reflection, like, why is it that I love snowboarding? It's not clear to you when you're doing it. It's only like after you step back and say, oh, what I love about this is that I'm with my family and I'm outside. And if you're not engaged in that sort of reflective activity, then it becomes really easy to be taken advantage of by these external motivators. So I'm just going to throw in that this sort of reflective mindfulness is absolutely essential to not being seduced by the external motivators. And, that's all I have to say.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I have here that it takes money to go places. Like for our study abroad trip, it took money to get there. Mm-hmm. But once I got there, it was like a life-changing experience. But it was only because we had the money to go there that I was able to do that. So, I mean, money does make the world go round, but it makes it easier. But I think that you have to have either this or probably both, but the reflective aspect that you just talked about, and also a strong enough character, which I think is very related, but like a character that's able to avoid being corrupted by the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know a lot of people, when I tell a lot of people that I'm going to law school, they're like, oh, okay. And I'm like, well, no, I'm going there because I want to change things and I want to do things. I want to help people, and I feel like that's the best way. And they're like, oh, okay, well, talk to me when you're actually a lawyer. And, you know, it makes me feel sad that that's the expectation, is that once I get there and I go in there with these ideals, they're basically what they're saying is when I get there, I'm just going to come out the stereotypical lawyer who just wants the money. And I mean, I don't think that I'm going to end up that way, but, you know, it makes me sad that these certain statuses that maybe at one time were held a value are now just amounted to money. And I don't know, I think it's very true, and I think that this hedonic treadmill is a useful tool to analyze the phenomenon that's going on and occurring around us. But I think that In learning about it and discussing it, you also need to have a remedy for it. And I think the remedy is to find value other than money in the events and the activities that you partake in.
I just want to, if I may,
yeah,
add on to this. Going back to the stereotypical view of lawyers, I think that it's really important, you know, it's very easy for people who don't know a lot about law and don't know lawyers who are doing good to have this negative view of the profession. But, you know, I can list many upstanding lawyers, judges, who are absolutely driven by something real that they're trying to realize on earth, that they realize is huge and, quote, bigger than themselves. And number one, such people exist. Number two, it's extremely important that we know of them so that when we're around people who are not that way or when we're around people who are speaking otherwise about the profession, we can call on those identities as a source of comfort. And so you may be, and you will be, totally alone in a decision that you have to make. And there's nobody, there's no living person around you that can help you, you know, remain virtuous and whatnot. And I think it's absolutely useful to know, like to have, you know, a silent board, if you will, of identities that you can, like we've talked about Henri Dunant, the founder of the International Committee of the Red Cross. So I think that's also, like, in terms of this reflective thing that we need, there's also, like, concrete role models to help us remember, you know, that there is this way to approach the profession, whether it's law or medicine or what have you, because you could always come up with good exemplars of people who are called to those professions. The other point I wanted to make is just about travel and money and so forth and snowboarding or snowmobiling, sorry. Yeah, when I think about travel, you do need money to travel. But then when I think about what I really get out of it and what makes it important, like a large part of it is this human connection, which, of course, you don't need to travel to develop human connection. And so I think it's important that when we travel to, again, reflect on why is it that we love this so much. And my own view is that, yes, we did go to The Hague, but I think that, and there are certain things that we saw there and experiences that we cannot simulate here, really. But I think that the sort of emotionally intense experiences we had over there, I think we could mimic that here. That's my view. So anyway, that's it.
Okay. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about how an individual can achieve true happiness, since we talked about the hedonic treadmill a little bit. You know, I think in what we just said, we've all kind of addressed this already, but, and I kind of brought this up earlier, but the idea that, like, wealthy people who can have any material object they ever want, how do they achieve true happiness? And I think it just goes back to, like, what I said earlier about, you know, that, you know, they have achieved this success and this money through their jobs or whatever, but they're happy when they do things for other people, or they volunteer, or they have a foundation that they created, some type of philanthropy. And their, like, happiness comes from seeing other people happy and doing things that make other people happy. And that makes, yeah, so, like, everyone's happiness feeds off each other. Do you guys have anything to add to this now, or I'm not sure. Well, anyways, I think this kind of has to do with, or this relates to kind of the reading that we did before tonight's show, and Richard Layard, who he, in the reading, it's a three-part speech that he gave to the London School of Economics in 2003. And in the second part, he talks about income and happiness and why we have greater wealth in our world but no greater happiness, and he refers to the hedonic treadmill. And he kind of talks about how he ultimately thinks we need to listen to the ideas of Jeremy Bentham, who said that, who believes that if you pursue a utilitarian philosophy of life where we care about others' well-being, generating greater overall happiness for ourselves and others, that's the way we can achieve happiness. You have to be conscious of others and what makes them happy. And I think this is, like, really important, too, because when I think about, like, trying to achieve success in this world, it seems like a lot of times people are tempted to, like, forget about others and, like, use others or, like, push them aside when they're trying to reach the top. But, like, that doesn't really, like, ultimately you won't feel good about doing that, and those people won't be happy. So I think that in pursuit of our happiness, we need to be mindful of each other, and that will actually make you more happy. Like, it has to do, it's not just like getting there, it's like the journey of how you get there. What do you guys think?
Personally, when I've read Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, which I think is like basically his son or protege. What I took from it is that, I mean, outside of his whole calculus and ways to actually assess utilitarian ideals, I think one of the best things I took from it is that your pursuit of pleasure and your pursuit of happiness, like you said, Erica, you have to take into account how that's going to affect other people. And I don't think, my personal interpretation is, I don't think like you have to say, okay, my goal is to make as many people around me as happy as I possibly can. Maybe that is a way to interpret it, but for me personally, it's like, okay, you're going to pursue things for you that are going to make you happy. But if what makes you happy is going to be at the detriment of all these other people, then that's not the morally acceptable thing to do. And I think mm-hmm. that that's fantastic, because in so doing, it eliminates a lot of the things that we've been talking about, finding pleasure in the wrong sort of things and getting happiness out of the wrong sort of things, because when you do that, you're going to affect others negatively. And but if you find pleasure in these right things, these things that we've been talking about, like you know, having some sort of virtue or some sort of goal that is fulfilling or productive or something like this, these, when you find happiness and pursue these sorts of pleasure, there's no way that it's going to have a negative effect on others. In fact, it will probably help and benefit others, which is what Bentham and the utilitarians that they are all about. I mean, like, an easy way to remember it is the greatest happiness or the greatest good for the greatest amount of people. And I think that he tried to instill, or he did encourage and, in fact, reform a lot of policies that aimed at this goal to increase the happiness of as many people as you can with this policy. And I think it's true at a government level, and I think it's true at a personal level, too, that if you try to pursue things that not only make you happy, but make the effects of which will make others happy, I think that that's absolutely the way to go. Now, I don't know if I'm a true utilitarian at heart, because I haven't read enough, but I think that the basic ideas of it ring very true to me, and I think it reflects what we've been talking about thus far.
Hope, do you have anything to add?
This is tricky, other people, because I'm sure you guys experience this in your own lives. Once you have other people in your life that you love, and you also have an activity or activities that you love, they're going to come into conflict with each other. And there's trade-offs that must be made. This is Nussbaum's fragility of goodness thesis. Anyway, so there's that. And I just want to draw a distinction, you know, between, or actually amongst various ways in which other people enter the equation. One is at the level of, okay, before I do this action, will this hurt anybody? And if so, avoid, maybe. Again, I could know that my going to law school may hurt my husband because I'm not going to be around very often, but still choose law. I mean, this is the tricky thing. So there's a question of whether this action will cause harm or distress to someone. But I also want to say that going back to this point about Henri Dunant, and this is, again, an appeal to Aristotle, who talks about the importance of friends in the later books of the Nicomachean Ethics. And he says that really, first of all, you can't have a lot of friends. It's just, it's too difficult. Like in terms of true friendship, a few amount of people, and that your true friends are the ones engaged in the same sorts of pleasurable activities that you are. so that you're really not going to get this conflict. And in fact, the friends are going to help remind you if you start to forget what's truly important. They actually remind you, yo, you know, mm-hmm. it's this that's really important, and they help to keep you on, and you all help each other. So people are necessary in that way, but you're not using them. It's more like you're involved in this pursuit together, and you realize that you all need each other.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing that I wanted to say, and I'll just leave it at this, is that when we talk about, Jeff, you're talking about these pleasurable activities, and let's choose the pleasurable activities that don't seem to harm people. Yeah, there's this doctrine of natural pleasures, and philosophers will say, ah, pursuing these pleasures will not harm people. But again, you know, once you have more than one valuable thing in your life, they're both natural pleasures, a trade-off will have to be made. So I just think it gets really tricky, and I'll leave it at that. So I just want to throw into there the possibility that there's going to be pain. You know, I mean, there's just no way around it if you're multifaceted, right? Mm-hmm. If you have more than one thing that you value, which is, I think, most of us. So, yeah.
Yeah, everything that you just said is basically what I've been thinking about as I'm in college and everything, because especially like the work that I do with you guys and the things that we study and we talk about and we spend a lot of time on, like that gives me great enjoyment, and I feel like I'm fulfilled through that, and I feel like I'm contributing something to the world, and that makes me really happy, and I enjoy devoting a lot of my time to it. But then at the same time, like I'm here in college and I'm meeting lots of wonderful people and I want to spend time with them. And I also think it's important to like develop those relationships with them. And so I get happiness from both, but you cannot choose. And I don't feel like I can, like you can't pick one as more important because they're both valuable. But the challenge is then balancing it. So you can achieve like your greatest happiness and be satisfied knowing you've done both, or you've done a certain amount of either is the best combination for you.
Absolutely. I think that that's so true, especially in college, because it's true in every part of life. But in college, a lot of people place a high importance on meeting people and you know, trying to find that group of friends that are lifelong versus the people who in high school maybe you were necessarily around but weren't true friends in the way that you consider a true friend, which is like Hope said, who actually helps you and you don't use them in any way, but you just gain satisfaction and just being around them helps you overall. And I think that it's a lot of what people struggle with is, do I put more importance on the social aspect or do I put more importance on the school aspect? And I think that a lot of people find it easier to find satisfaction out of the social aspect than it is the schooling. And we've talked about this even a couple shows ago. And this is one of the reasons that I'm hesitant to subscribe myself to the utilitarian movement, is that the whole thing about avoiding pain and pursuing pleasure just kind of rubs me the wrong way, because there's so many times in my life where I've went through really painful activities but came out better, and upon this whole reflection I was like, okay, it really wasn't that bad, first of all, and second of all, I'm way happier by going through that pain. A couple examples are like Hell Week for football, which is absolutely terrible, but in the end you're way better conditioned, you know your stuff, and then you're happier out on the field and after looking back. School is the same way. Sometimes it sucks, quite frankly, sitting down and reading 6 chapters in a night. But at the end, I get a great accomplishment. I'm like, nice, I actually did it. I set my goal. I'm better because of it. And I don't know exactly how Jeremy Bentham would address it. I think one of his purity clauses would make it okay, but we won't go there. So this whole thing about weighing pains and pleasures, I think, first of all, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And second, you're going to have, like Hope said, you're going to have to make some cuts somewhere. There's just, frankly, there's not enough time to do everything. Mm-hmm. Like, there was, I know that today I wanted to get all my reading done for my exam so I could make note cards tomorrow. I didn't have enough time. And it bugs me because I want to. But also, I know it's my roommate's birthday today, so I want to go home and, like, hang out with him and say happy birthday, you
know?
Happy
birthday, Jack.
Yeah. So it's that weighing, but at the same time, I think that there is a way to discern the pains that are okay, and it's almost like a hierarchy of happiness. So for Hope's example of going to law school, she would necessarily be away from her husband, which sucks for both of them, but overall, the happiness that she's going to get from going to law school outweighs it. And, I mean, obviously, Hope's husband was on board with that,
mm-hmm.
and rightfully so.
He was.
And that just means that they're good for each other, and that's something that's true. So I think that finding the people, first of all, makes it a whole lot easier to make those cuts, and because when you find someone who actually recognizes that what you're doing is for the overall greater good or going to, you know, produce some sort of higher happiness, like, then if they should be on board, and if they're not, then I don't think that they are your true friend. But, I mean, when, you know, this whole thing of pursuing pleasures and pains, I think there are absolutely certain pleasures and certain ways of gaining happiness that trump others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to be mindful of that. And, yeah, I think I'm going to end it there.
Okay. And just to, you know, comment on this a little bit more, like, for me, it's really kind of, like, I can wrap my head around it, but, like, I can't come out one way or the other. I'm like, okay, you're doing work, and it's giving you satisfaction, and you might have to sacrifice time with other people, but the work that you're doing, will it benefit more people than the people that would benefit if you spent time with them? You know, like, I'm just thinking about, like, how Hope, mm-hmm. you went to law school and everything, like, you had to sacrifice time with your husband, but then at the same time, like, your skills as a lawyer might benefit more than just one person if you had spent time with your husband. But then I also think about things like the people who came before you and made sacrifices in their work or whatever so that you could enjoy, like, time with your husband, you know,
mm-hmm.
like how we all affect each other somewhere
mm-hmm.
or another. And, you know, like, something I do in my life, I might not consciously plan on it affecting somebody else because we're always constantly, like, in change, and what
mm-hmm.
I do is a ripple effect to somebody else. But, like, just is my work going to affect more people than if I was just spending time with individuals, or spending time with those individuals, is that going to have a greater effect, like, on how I interact with them, how they interact with others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to propose that there's two moral frameworks that we could work with here, and one is the assuming with the utilitarians that, you know, our objective should be maximizing the happiness of as many people as possible. And it's not the case that my husband was on board with law school because I was going to benefit more people with it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in our vows to each other, it was really I respect and will cultivate the development and self-actualization of you. And so it's more like getting on board with that person's development. And in that case, it's really like individual development, which is paramount at the personal level. Like, once you start making policy, and this is where utilitarianism can come into also. So
mm-hmm.
it's one thing to make personal private decisions,
mm-hmm.
but then you start getting into, like, legislation, policy making, different equations
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But at least at the personal level, we can choose between doing those things and engaging in some sort of deliberation about the extent to which I'm going to maximize the happiness of others, and that could be the main thing that I'm focused on, or it could be, how is this developing myself? And so when you have these conflicts, another way of resolving the tension, apart from, okay, well, this is going to maximize happiness for more people, so I go with that, you could also ask yourself, which one is going to promote maximal development of me?
Mm-hmm.
In which case, the individual becomes really the focus of the moral decision-making. And so I just wanted to introduce those two different ways of resolving the tension.
Erica, I think your point of all of us being connected is an awesome insight, because to combine your guys' last two comments, I think that from what I just worked out and had like my little aha moment in my head right now, is that...
That's a good pleasure.
Yeah, exactly. I think that really... I mean, this is just going on a whim here, but I think
you
that...
You try it.
That's what I'm doing. I think that maybe the best way to realize these utilitarian ideals and ideas is that you improve yourself, you do what makes you happy, you make yourself this really good person that you're proud to be, and then that way you're in a position to, when you do interact with others, when you do the things that make you happy and produce things, the work that you accomplish in your life, that aren't necessarily foreseen or intentional to benefit these people, but by being a sound character, by being the person who you really want to be, then as a necessary result, you're going to benefit other people. And maybe it will benefit a lot of people, maybe it only benefit a few, but then again, who's to say that those few won't go out and benefit other people as a result? So.
And maybe everyone will hate you.
Yeah, maybe.
Especially your family.
Yeah.
Because they'll think that you're being... But no, actually the evidence is to the contrary. Mm-hmm. That there's evidence of people who are doing things that jeopardize time with their family, but their family is like in love with them nonetheless, mm-hmm. because they see that there's something else,
right.
something bigger than themselves. Yeah, and that's a view, and it's known as ethical humanism.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, having just discussed, we started with what Richard Layard had to say about happiness, and we had had a clip on him, but if you're interested in looking at it, you can go to the Ethics Talk page. But we also have a clip from the Dalai Lama about happiness, and so we can play that now.
Okay, and the clip is like a minute and a half.
Yes.
Here it comes. Hopefully, we've been having trouble with these clips, but here it comes.
Ultimately, you see, the thing is, we want happiness. We do not want suffering. Everybody, any sentient being. Now we are actually creating more unnecessary suffering. I think very important to make clear to public, this is, we are not talking about religion. If we have more compassion, God will please. We are not talking that. As a Buddhist, if we practice compassion, Buddha will support us. I'm not talking that. If we are a more compassionate person, I get more benefit. I will be more happier person. That's the point. Here, I think one check, $1 million. But here, no peace. That $1 million will not bring inner peace, happiness. More frustration. This money bring more frustration, more suspicion, more anxiety, or sometimes more jealousy then. So inner peace is the ultimate source of happiness, joyfulness. So I think people do not understand that, isn't it? That's my point.
All right. So basically, he is summarizing some of the ideas that we talked about in tonight's show, where money or $1 million check cannot directly buy you happiness, but maybe, as we've talked about, it can buy you happiness indirectly by what you choose to do with it, and if you choose to do good things, and you know, that can give you happiness and others happiness. And so he kind of talked about too, touched on this idea of like utilitarianism and like acknowledging other people and their happiness, when he said, you know, we have to have compassion for each other in order to achieve this inner peace, which gives you happiness. And you can't always get this inner peace from money, which you can, though, if you're maybe using your money with compassion for others. Mm-hmm. But, it has to be, you have to have, like, compassion and consider other people and, like, do good things in order to achieve this happiness. Do you guys have anything else that you wanted to say about that?
Yeah, actually, when I was listening to that, it made me think of something that was said in one of my classes today, and I can't verify this statistic or this piece of information, but the person who said it certainly seemed like they knew what they were talking about. She said that there was some study done comparing the depression rates of women in Kenya, I believe, versus women in, like, Orange County or something. And they actually found that the women in Orange County were more depressed than the women in Kenya, who are subject to really, really inhumane and really abysmal circumstances versus these women in Orange County who are living in million-dollar homes and driving sports cars. And it was really interesting because, A, that proves our point right away that money doesn't buy happiness. But also, it seems that by putting value in the things that some of these women have, it actually makes them worse off because they never achieve the goals that they want to, which I think is what the hedonic treadmill is touching on. So if they want to have the biggest house on the block and they want to be the most beautiful woman on the block, you know, those things you can't really achieve. They're unachievable goals. So that's what that clip made me think of, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll add that this idea of the importance of compassion and the integral role that it plays in the happy life, for me it connects to flow, because when you're compassionate and you exercise compassion, to truly exercise compassion is to, you know, in the face of rage, justified rage, maybe that's a bit strong, but, you know, you're in a situation, and instead of demonizing the other people, the other person, you remember that they're a human being, maybe they had a bad day today, and you're able to bring that to bear on the situation and sort of restrain your rage. I think that, like, being able to do that and not being taken over by negative emotions, even if they're justified, is a type of, you know, self-diverting of your attention away from the self in the way that flow activity does. Mm-hmm. That's pleasurable, because once you do that, you extinguish the pain, because it's anger is painful. Aristotle says it. But to, you know, bring this memory, like this is a person, and go through this inner dialogue, I just want to connect it to a type of flow activity, or it has the same sort of benefits that flow does, because it does remove us from our narrow self-interest, as it were. So that's why. So I think that compassion plays an important role in terms of when we think of the role that attention plays in happiness.
What you just made me think of is the other day we were driving down Mission, which for those of you who don't live in Mount Pleasant, Mission is awful. But we were coming home, and a car just completely pulled out in front of us, and they were going really fast and driving dangerously, and the person who was driving, justifiably so, got really upset. And then one of us, I was like, obviously they had a place to go, and so we were like, well, I hope they get there. And then it really changed the whole mood from, wow, being, you know, pissed off at this person to, okay, well, let's hope whatever they're doing isn't, like, hopefully they're not going to visit someone who's sick or something like that. It's just, I think then that doesn't capture everything that you just said, but I think it's a good analogy.
A paradigm shift.
And I think, like, tie everything back together. It's just like how when we started out, we said, like, you know, you decide your own happiness. And I think, like, having this compassion for others helps you decide to be happy, because, you know, even though, like your own dependence or your own happiness is, like, dependent on other people somehow, it's because you decide to, like, care about other people. And that's how by deciding to care about other people and, like, recognize their well-being, then you're deciding that, like, you are going to be happier because those around you are happier.
Nice.
And with that, I think that a wonderful first hosting show for me, everyone.
Really good job.
And,
awesome.
Yeah, a good discussion tonight. So thanks for listening to Ethics Talk. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.